Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm here with my co-host, Dave Allen, bringing you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events. And it is Tuesday, October 3, 2023. Hi, Dave.
Hey, Melody. How are you?
Fabulous. Thank you.
What a day. An incredible, sunny, blue-skied, warm fall day. I guess this is what they call Indian summer.
Yeah.
Even if it's just one day, you know, I will take it.
Yeah, it is just one day, and it's just kind of a thumbing nose at us. This is going to be the last nice week until March or April.
No.
Oh, well, I don't know. Who knows? With El Nino, it should be in, you know, there's certain parts of the country that are supposed to get whacked with snow, but I think we're pretty good, and it might be a very nice winter for us. So I'll take it.
Good friends who have a summer home in the hills of Colorado who just sent me three photos of snow that they got last night. It's like, oh my gosh, already.
Yes, already. And we're all ready for the gold and silver prices today. Well, we're still a little negative across the precious metals with as we're seeing some strength in, you know, the dollar numbers. I'm not going to say we see strength in the dollar because the dollar has no strength, but in the numbers that they attach to it are higher. And so we saw gold down today after a big day yesterday, down $3 at $18.95. Silver, though, was up 13 cents at 21.27, so hopefully it can hold that $21 level. Platinum was down $6 at $880, and palladium was down 24 at $1,214. Now, as I mentioned, the dollar is holding at 107, so it's that is, I think, a pretty key number right there, 107, with the in the relationship to gold pricing. Crude oil was up just a little bit, 89.55. And the markets got whacked today. I think at one point in time, the Dow was down 500, but now it's 430, 33,002. S&P is down 58 at 4,229. And NASDAQ was down 248. 13,059. So the NASDAQ was down the most, 1.87%. The Dow was down just a little over 1.25%. European markets, I believe they were all negative. Most of them were down a little over 1%. Asian markets, Hang Seng and Nikkei were down. Hang Seng was down almost 3%. Nikkei was down a little over 1.5%. So we have the Shanghai was strong, but, you know, by just a couple points, so no biggie there. Talk of the day is the 10-year and the 30-year. But right now we're going to give you the yield on the 10-year, 4.80. So a 16. Now we can add that to a 16-year high. And that is not good. That is not good. Although we're going to hear about how great it is, but it is not. And as I do believe, as those yields go up, the value of those bonds go down. So there you go. And I believe they're talking about the 30-year. It's at the highest in a long time. And I just said yesterday, it's not going to be long before we see 8% mortgage rates. And they're talking about that today. Natural gas up 0.10, up almost, 3.75%, 2.944. So a pretty active day in the market. And, you know, again, the debate, are we or won't we, recession, no recession, soft landing, hard landing, it doesn't matter, folks. You're losing your purchasing power. And that's what really counts. And that's, for some people, it might be a soft landing. And for other people, it's going to be so hard. They're, you know, it's going to be a lot harder than what do they anticipate. So, you know, hey, we see job openings. They rose in August. Supposedly a sign that the labor market remains strong despite these higher interest rates. And so, you know, people can rejoice thinking that this is a good sign that the economy is strong. It also means that those interest rates are going to be higher and held longer. Which is not good for the economy and for many businesses either. American employers posted 9.6 million job openings in August, up from 8.9 in July. And the number of layoffs and of people quitting their jobs were basically unchanged from July. Let's see if there's anything else in there. But, you know, Dave, if the job openings rose, couldn't that also be a sign of people getting whacked, people getting moving from position to position? Or it's not that these are new job openings, that these are just job openings. That means a job came available, right?
Not necessarily. I mean, we don't know from... We have to dig deeper to see which of them is, you mean, newly created as opposed to...
Yeah, they're not newly created. That would come in the Friday's jobs report that they claim as newly created, even though some of them are just jobs that are going back to work from the pandemic. They're not newly created, you know, and it's the same thing. Or is it just semantics? You know, is this, you know, how do we know? Do we know that these job openings that unexpectedly rose aren't from people being laid off or... striking, or, you know, of course they don't.
Well, we may have to wait until Thursday to see how initial unemployment claims, jobless claims, come in relative to the week before. And we know those claims are down over the past couple of weeks. So I you know, it's hard to say. I mean, what gets me is that, you know, at any chance they get, whether it's the media, whether it's elected officials, the White House, keep talking about headline unemployment at 3.8% in August, remaining near a half century low. Well, if that were even close to being accurate, that would be pretty gosh darn impressive in my own mind. But we have to say that the government's U6 unemployment rate, which includes the longer-term discouraged job seekers, is hovering around 7%. Now, I guess pick your poison. But at least have the integrity when you're saying 3.8% that it's, you know, the headline rate, and it excludes these discouraged workers who just stop looking because they can't find something either that they qualify or that they'll be hired for. You know, I can't tell you how many of my my friends similar to my age who have even the slightest graying in their temples, much less, you know, all gray on the sides and no hair on top, they're just not getting called, much less hired. I mean, there's rampant ageism in today's job market. I think a lot of companies, big and small, are missing out on the experience and the wisdom that comes with that experience. The track there, but.
Well, you know, but if you have a manager that's, you know, 40 or 30, 40, they're not going to hire anyone that's 60 plus. They're just not going to, they're going to hire someone more there.
They're lost. Their age. Good luck with finding,
I know.
Finding qualified people.
I get it.
You know, it's a big mess out there. I mean, yesterday you got the Cleveland Fed Prez, Loretta Mester, talking about rising gas prices, thwarting progress on inflation. She emphasized that the Fed may still hike rates by the end of the year. Michelle Bowman, a newer member of the Fed board, talking about the possible need for multiple increases in the coming months. To rein it in. As of lunchtime today, the CME Fed Fund futures traders see about a 68% probability that the Fed will leave rates alone when it next meets in November. But they now see a roughly 50-50 chance of another 25 basis point rise in December. So markets are coming around to Jay Powell and his comrades' thinking. The Fed is going to go higher and stay there longer.
Well, let Melody Cederstrom say this, that it doesn't matter how long they raise the rates or how long they hold it, it's not going to affect the price of inflation, because inflation that they're targeting is not a symptom of what they tell it. It's a symptom of our monetary policy, of our fiat dollar, and all their little interest rates and all of their little hoping to get it down to 2% isn't going to work. It won't work. And in the meantime, you get all these small businesses, and yeah, they're beginning to complain to Powell about it. You know, they're complaining about, you know, inflation, high interest rates, labor shortages, and yada, yada, yada. But also the danger is they got debt that they got to roll over at these higher rates, and they can't service it. They can't pay the monthly fees, their loan amounts, their payments. And it isn't just a little bit. They're huge jumps. And you have, I mean, to the, you know, so yeah, it's a big problem. So, and if they're going to use the targeting of the 2% as their little goal, it's not going to happen. Or they'll just flat out lie about it and say it is. And again, you know, famous Greenspan's words is, doesn't matter what we do, is what we say. So if they say, hey, inflation is 2%, everybody's going to believe them. Except for those who go to the store and buy food and buy gasoline. And so small businesses are complaining. You know, Patrick Harker, head of the Philly Fed, traveled to York to learn about the efforts of a longtime manufacturing hub where York peppermint patties were once made to diversify its economy. The businesses they spoke with were generally optimistic. Well, of course, they have to be. But they still have the same concerns about it. It isn't easy out there. And if it isn't easy for businesses and people alike now, even a soft landing is going to be major damage to them. it will be definitely a hard landing. So yeah, if you're up there and you're making millions of dollars and blah, 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 yeah, it's going to be a soft landing. It's always a soft landing for those guys. And those are the guys out there saying, hey, it's going to be a soft landing. But anyway, go ahead, Dave.
Well, he and Harker were in downtown York, Pennsylvania, where he also met business owner Jennifer Heasley. She owns Sweet Mama's Mamba Sauce, makes a barbecue-style sauce, and owns a food stall in the York Central Market. And when she was asked before the visit what she would most want to tell Powell, she said, lower interest rates. She said she's one of those small business owners who incurs her debt on credit cards, which she sometimes uses to fund her business. And like all Americans, she's paying a higher rate, a much higher rate these days. And it ain't going to get any lower soon. Lack of childcare is another problem for many businesses in that area. It's going to boomerang, expand many times over with the end of pandemic era assistance. One business owner, complained that the lack of adequate child care, is keeping too many parents out of the workforce. They can't hire enough of people. Told officials there were 219 child care centers in the area before the pandemic. Now they're only 170. And a lot of those, Melody, I suppose, will be closing or limiting their services in the coming months. Now, Tom Pallison, who was director of the, this looks like the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, complained about higher interest rates, leading many local companies to pull back on acquisitions and investment in technology. And he said, look, companies want to invest, but they've hit the pause button. And the question to ask as a follow-up is, can you blame them?
No, you can't. But, well, they should. That's a smart decision. But, these hedge funds, Dave, you can tell us about this, because I was reading yesterday how now they're planning, to dump or reverse their buying of treasuries and so forth. And I don't know if this is a part of that, to where they're looking to, again, try to control these markets with AI.
Yeah, it's modestly related to that, I believe. But it looks as though hedge funds are increasingly piling into efforts to create artificial intelligence that can teach itself to beat the market. So far, it hasn't happened, but I think they're suggesting, well, let's give it time. The technology for years has struggled to crack the actual business of investing, thank goodness. The machine's getting bamboozled by all the noise in financial markets and getting caught off guard by what this article calls fickle trends. Eureka Hedge Index of 12 funds using AI has trailed its broader hedge fund index by about 14 percentage points over the last 5 years. Yet AI advocates say they're not striving for market thumping returns, just a slight edge. Well, Michael Kuritnoff, who's a veteran of the CERN, Nuclear Research Lab in Geneva, that huge monstrosity, said in finance, you can be very successful by being just a little bit better than 50%. An interesting take, Melody.
Wow. Let's see. Where do we want to go? Oh, those hedge funds that I were talking about, is they're looking to be selling about $30 billion in stocks here in the next week or so. I don't know the time frame on that. They just say soon. So they're using computers to sell up to $30 billion of stocks soon. Well, when you think of how many trillions of dollars in there, $30 billion is really not a whole lot of money. So it'll, it might add some I don't know if it would add any, you know, trends to it to where it would make people follow suit. But, and one more thing, Dave, did you see where J.P. Morgan got hit with another federal fine for $40 million derivative violation? So now you can, now it could be seven.
Phoenix.
Seven felonies now? We'll be right back. Six.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSC Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSCTalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cederstrom. I'm here with Dave Allen. You can call us at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. And you can visit our website at dgscoins.com. dgscoins.com. And we're going to talk a little bit about, and you know what's funny, Dave? I don't know if I can pull it up here real quick, but I was reading an article today about how our lifespan, the American lifespan, is drastically falling. And, you know, to where it was, we certainly have peaked, and now it is being reversed. However, you can live to a healthy 100, right?
Hey, given today's lifespan, that's a positive way of looking at it. The way humans are wired has a lot to do, however, with whether we'll live to that ripe old age. Triple digits, but it's not the only factor. And that's good news for those of us with genes that aren't necessarily cooperative. As the oldest and fittest of us baby boomers age into triple digits over the next quarter century, and medicine finds new ways to treat and cure things like heart disease and cancer, more of us than ever are expected to live to see the century mark. Our behaviors, diet, exercise, even sun exposure account for three quarters of what gets us to 90. with our genes playing a 25% role. Before beyond 90, the script flips and genes play the decisive role in taking us the rest of the way. It's according to William Cole, who writes in his new book, The Big 100, The New World of Superaging, out tomorrow. Now, Cole, who's a veteran reporter and editor and foreign correspondent, interviewed dozens of longevity experts and centenarians for his book, including a vibrant 112-year-old. He offers these five life hacks for making the most of what we have to work with. First, he says to just chill out. Toxic stress is the enemy of longevity. Stress triggers a release of hormones that take energy away from our cells' longevity-promoting activities. So if there's a way to ease or avoid stress in your life, just do it. Second, keep moving. That super centenarian Hertel Senhouse's best advice, and she should know. At 112, she dines out regularly, attends church, and plays the slots at a casino outside Boston. Go, girl. Even something as humdrum as a little brisk vacuuming. Vacuuming, experts say, can benefit our bodies and our minds. Third, get your Z's. In a culture that pushes us to wring every last ounce of productivity from every waking hour of the day, many of us neglect good sleep. American College of Cardiology says healthy sleep habits boost life expectancy by 4.7 years for men, 2.4 for women. Number four, stay connected. U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy recently proclaimed loneliness and isolation as a public health crisis. And the National Institute on Aging says their impact is like smoking 15 cigarettes every day. Wow. And last but certainly not least, think positive. The world's oldest living person, American-born Spaniard Maria Brañas Morera, insists she's 116 because she always looks on the bright side of life. But it's more than just wishful thinking. In a study of about 160,000 U.S. women over, age 50 to 79, found that those who scored highest for optimism were 10% more likely to live beyond 90. Bottom line, Melody, although there are steps we can take to optimize our shot at 100, Cole says living past 105 requires hitting all five numbers in the genetic lottery plus the Powerball. And that is this week's Levity is Golden.
Yeah, and you know what? Those are such simple steps. And I know our bodies, I think no matter what age we're at, we are, if you change things, your body reacts to the positive. You know, as long as you haven't gone too far down the path. But, you know, it's interesting because that article that I was telling you about, and I think living to 100 is certainly in our time frame, because this is out by the, I think, the Washington Post. And they said that the chronic diseases have been the greatest threat, killing far more people between 35 and 64 every year. So those diseases are killing, and the diseases is like diabetes and liver disease, heart and cancer. And so, you know, these are just things that you can avoid. And
their lifestyle, a lot of them are lifestyle-driven diseases.
Yep,
and,
exactly.
More and more, the healthcare community are coming around to the number one priority, and that's to eat well, have a healthy diet.
Mm-hmm.
Not just that, but that's more and more the number one suggestion.
Absolutely. So there's a lot of things that we can do to be healthy as we age. Because I think everybody would like to live to 90 as long as they function, well.
Yeah.
You know, but hey, anyway, because I because it's like tomorrow, it can be a different world for you. You know, people that are 70 plus, it can change, or it really could be any age, really. But as you age, stuff happens, and we're not 39 for the rest of our lives. But let's move on, and it's a good thing. It should make you happy. So anyway, I can't figure this one out. Macy's, they said they're going to open up 30 smaller stores in strip malls over the next 2 years. They didn't announce the locations, but said the additional stores will start to open next year. Now, I'm thinking strip malls. You know, a lot of these strip malls are, unless you get into some of these, what are they called? These little...
Yeah, the town centers. I mean, I think they're talking about like where the Kohl's are and part of a big, you know, supermarket anchor.
Yeah, but you know, when I think of Macy's, I don't think of them as a strip mall store. You know, but you know, if you look at Macy's for the past, I don't know, 10 years, 15, 20 years, their quality really has. It's not Macy's that was once the, you know, the
place to shop.
The place, you know, well, it was just a.
And it had a Strawbridge and Clothier in Philadelphia.
It had a higher quality to it. Not anymore. To me, it's not much more than Walmart anymore. But anyway, so they're looking to expand. And I think that's a good thing. Macy's have faced a lot of challenges. Middle-income Americans who drive most of their sales, they're beginning to watch their spending and look at the debt, look at the credit card rates. So maybe they're not using their credit card so much on things that you would buy at Macy's, but more on food and energy, Dave.
Yeah, well, with weak retail sales expected to persist, Macy's, I like this title, CSO, Chief Stores Officer, Mark Mastronardi, said small format stores are part of the solution. Macy's apparently has tested the shops, which are roughly one-fifth the size of its traditional mall stores. They've tested it for about 4 years now. Stores offer a slimmed-down mix of merchandise. They host local events, have more modern and open looks. Plus, they're next to the big store boxes, the grocers and the off-price retailers like TJ Maxx. Mastronardi said the high level of convenience in places that have a lot of traffic, that's the secret sauce. Well, we'll see. I mean, the off-mall stores have put a stronger results than the rest of Macy's, and based on the company's owned shopper surveys, those stores are getting high marks from consumers for being easy to shop, neat, organized, and staffed by, listen to this, helpful and friendly employees.
What stores are those?
Go Macy's are apparently on the way back.
Yeah, well, we'll just watch for that Mark Mastronardi until he's on the unemployment line.
Yeah, really.
It'd be interesting to know what 4 years were those 4 years during the COVID pandemic.
I would think it's the last 4 years.
Mm. Well, good luck, Macy's. You're going to need it. Cheesecake Factory is always a good store to visit. Now according to a new paper from Moody's Analytics, now we're going to gauge the financial health of a mall by the Cheesecake Factory. I think they're really trying, Dave, to grasp at straws. But anyway, about 93% of loans backed by malls with the Cheesecake Factory are current on their payments. Compared that to around 72% of those without the restaurant. Matt Reedy, he's the director of commercial real estate economics at Moody's, said the presence of certain stores within a mall, like a Lululemon or an Apple store, can be an unscientific measuring stick for the prospects of one mall over another, Dave.
This sounds like the topic of a summer internship.
I know,
I'm not necessarily making fun of it. It just seems a little out of the ordinary. But hey, anything to give somebody a new angle, right? Reedy added, people go to the malls to go to Apple. They don't go to a mall and end up at Apple. He said he noticed the same pattern for Cheesecake Factory. He wrote this paper titled, Get In, Loser, We're Going Shopping, Checking In on U.S. Malls. He wrote it in honor of Mean Girls Day, a.k.a. October 3rd, today. It's a day mentioned in the 2004 movie that lives on as a meme to many of its fans. Turns out the mall featured in that movie, Westfield Old Orchard outside of Chicago, does indeed have a Cheesecake Factory.
You know, they always say that when things get tough, you know, you should always invest in alcohol because the bars fill up. People go to the bars to, well, you know, if you don't drink, what do? You eat.
Yeah, absolutely.
So maybe that's a sign of it could also be the sign of, you know, people are distressed and they're going to the Cheesecake Factory to eat.
That is solid comfort food.
Yeah, you bet it is. So,
yeah.
So two sides of a coin. But Supreme Court is set to hear oral arguments today in a case with the potential to cut the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. That was created in the 2008 financial crisis. The KCFPB versus Community Financial Services Association of America hinges on the constitutionality of the agency's funding. Consumer advocates say if the high court sides with the CFSA, a trade group representing payday lenders, its ruling could have broad and significant impacts. For example, any rules the CFPB has issued in the past 12 years, whether about credit cards, mortgages, payday loans, debt collections, could be nullified. Some regulators like the Federal Reserve and the government programs like Social Security share a similar funding model. They may also be called into question, and this could come as late as June 2024. So the Bureau was established in 2011 by the Dodd-Frank Financial Reform Law, and you know, as consumers need protection from the government. So it's supposed to protect consumers from predatory financial practices. I don't think it's working really well, Dave.
Well, they have, I think, some solid successes to point to. There are also some potential.
Who's gone to jail?
Well, it's not necessarily their job to send people to jail. That's Department of Justice and some of the other regulators. But it's not that there's not been some overreach there, or, as you're suggesting, underreach in certain cases. And look, the Supreme Court's already ruled against the agency in 2020, interestingly finding part of its structure to be unconstitutional, but ultimately deciding to leave well enough alone. Now, in the current case, this trade group sued the CFPB in 2018, seeking to invalidate a 2017 rule it implemented that cracked down on payday lenders. Talk about predatory. The case was ultimately heard by the U.S. Court of Appeals in the Fifth Circuit, which ruled last October that the CFPB's funding mechanism violates the Constitution's Appropriations Clause. Now, it turns out the agency, like a few others, isn't subject to annual congressional appropriations. The CFPB is an independent agency with a funding structure that goes through the Federal Reserve, of all places. That's an attempt to shield the agency from political pressures. in particularly the appropriations process. Its director requests funds each year, and they're capped at 12% of the Fed's total operating expenses. I imagine 12% is a pretty significant chunk of change, Melody.
It does seem that way. And it seems this way. We hear the music. That means we're heading into a break. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. Please stay with us.
It's a girl, my lord, in a flatbed Ford, slowing down to take a look at me. Come on, baby. Don't say nay. I gotta know if your sweet love is gonna save.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interest of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And welcome back to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. Melody taking care of other client businesses. Final segment. She's at 1-800-375-4188. Hey, some good news coming out of Eastern Europe. Ukraine, Poland, and Lithuania have agreed on a plan they hope will help expedite Ukrainian grain exports. Officials said today, with needy countries beyond Europe potentially benefiting from speedier procedures. The deal means that grain inspections will shift from the Ukraine-Poland border to a Lithuanian port on the Baltic Sea. Who seeks to facilitate the transit of Ukrainian exports through Polish territory without providing any further details at this point. From the Lithuanian port of Klaipėda, where the inspections for pests and plant disease will take place, the grain can be exported by sea all around the world. While the agreement's stated goal is to hasten Ukrainian grain exports, it may also help diffuse some tensions over grain prices between Ukraine and Poland at a time when some support for Kyiv's efforts in the Russian war may be fraying. Ukraine, by the way, is a major global supplier of wheat, barley, corn, and vegetable oil. Our latest American Survival newsletter has hit the streets. I have a piece in it called Deficits and Debt, Part 1 of 4 parts. October is the Federal Reserve's National Economic Education Month. According to the Fed's website, this commemoration is designed to help all students understand how everyday economic decisions and policies affect their lives, their families, and their world. In a town hall held in the nation's capital last Thursday to ring in the NEE month, Powell told assembled educators, "The Fed's ability to influence the economy depends on whether people understand what we are saying," and highlighting the importance of the work of economic educators. "When the Fed publishes projections for interest rates in the economy," Powell continued, "one of our goals is to influence spending and investment decisions today and in the months ahead. And that will only be the case if people understand what we are saying and what it means for their own finances." Well, what fortuitous timing with National Economic Education Month coinciding with the federal government's start of a new fiscal year. It's a prime time to review how the government's finances fared over the past year, where the nation's public debt stands, and where it looks to be going. And such a look back and a gaze forward raises countless basic as well as existential questions like, what's the difference between deficits and debt? How do gross national debt and debt held by the public differ? How have deficits and the debt grown over the years? Has the government ever paid down its debt? How much national debt is too much? What are the pros and cons of incurring public debt? Should the government try to put the brakes on future debt and start to pay it off? More to the point, does governmental debt even matter anymore? Well, these are the 33 plus trillion dollar questions we'll be addressing over the next 4 Mondays this month as part of National Economic Education Month. In part one, we head back to the classroom to learn or relearn the basics. In part two next week, we'll take a look back at the hows and whys deficits and the debt have risen since the nation's founding. In part three, we'll look ahead and compare some dire deficit and debt projections. Finally, in part four, we'll hear some counterpoints on how much debt is too much for the nation to bear, some ideas for paying down our debt, and address the quintessential question, does the level of debt even matter? First, deficits versus debt. These two seemingly innocuous terms are often used interchangeably in conversation when in fact they're fundamentally different. Federal government operates on a fiscal year that runs from October 1 through the following September 30th. Generally speaking, Congress passes individual appropriation bills, or more recently, continuing or omnibus resolutions, through which they fund federal agency operations. Simply speaking, a budget deficit occurs when the government's total spending in a given year, fiscal year that is, exceeds its total revenues. For example, in fiscal year 2022, the 2023 figures, which ended on the 30th, aren't yet available. Total government spending last fiscal year was 6.272 trillion, while total revenues were 4.896, resulting in a deficit of 1.375 trillion, equivalent to about 5.5% of GDP. Firstly, when total revenues exceed total spending, the government runs a budget surplus. We hear much about surpluses because they don't happen very often, and they haven't since our nation's founding. Theoretically, annual budget deficits is a uniquely Washington thing. Since the end of the gold standard in the early 70s, the government has run a budget surplus just 5 times. There were another seven surpluses dating back to the early post-World War II days, averaging $4.7 billion a year in then-current dollars. For the post-1970 three surpluses occurred during Clinton's presidency, his second term, in fact, averaging $140 billion a year, again, in current dollars. The other surplus, $3 billion, well, that was actually in 1969, was generally attributable to Congress's budget adopted during the last year of LBJ's term. Now, the size of the federal deficit or surplus is largely influenced by the performance of the economy and spending and revenue policy set by Congress and the president. The economy's performance or health is usually framed in the context of growth or shrinkage in the nation's GDP, levels of employment and joblessness, and price stability. In a nutshell, when consumers and businesses make less money, income taxes and other revenues collected by the government also decrease. Similarly, when the economy is growing, more people are employed and everyone's earning more money, the government collects more. On the spending side, the increase or decrease of spending also impacts the budget, again, leading to deficits or surpluses. Example, nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office estimates that a 1 percentage point rise in inflation in 2024 would increase 2024 revenues by $36 billion and increase 2024 spending by $39 billion for a net increase of an additional $3 billion in the deficit. Now, notably, I think, CBO estimates that a 1 percentage point rise in interest in 2024 would decrease 2024 revenues by $32 billion and increase 2024 spending by $39 billion, resulting in a whopping increase of $71 billion in the 2024 deficit. So economic assumptions matter. The real economy, what it does, matters. Congressional legislation and White House action that increases spending that's greater than revenues also increases the deficit, all else equal. For example, annual budget deficits have spiked because of spending from events like the Great Recession, revenue impacts from the Trump tax cuts, and the forever wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, and elsewhere since 2001. More recently, massive spending increases related to widespread unemployment and health care, like the CARES Act in 2020, the American Rescue Plan Act in 2021, and the Inflation Reduction Act last year caused major spikes in the deficit as well. Now, turning to the national debt, to pay for its annual deficits, the government borrows money by selling treasury bonds and other securities. The national debt is simply the accumulation of this borrowing, along with interest owed to investors who bought the securities. As the government experiences recurring deficits, the national debt grows. Now, the two primary components of our national debt are debt held by the public. U.S. debt is mainly held by the American public, followed by foreign governments, U.S. banks, and investors. I mean, debt held by the public in general includes individuals, corporations, state and local governments, Federal Reserve banks, foreign investors and governments, and other entities other than the U.S. government itself. And then the other part is intragovernmental debt. This debt is held by the federal government itself. It is what one part of the government owes to another part. Major examples include the Social Security and Medicare trust funds, Civil Service Retirement Trust Fund, and several others. Now, intergovernmental debt hasn't increased as much as publicly held debt because it mainly includes debt on federal programs, surplus revenue invested in treasury debt. As of August 31st, of the nation's total gross debt then of $32.91 trillion, $26 trillion of it, 79%, was debt held by the public, while $6.9 roughly trillion, or 21%, was intergovernmental debt. To illustrate an oversimplification of how debt grows from year to year, let's say the total gross debt at the end of fiscal year 2022 was $31.6 trillion. Add to that CBO's estimated 2023 budget deficit of, well, minimum of $1.5 trillion, and you get a current gross debt of $33.1 billion, just adding the two figures. Federal government's required to also to pay periodic interest to lenders for the use of their money in the same way that lenders charge an individual interest for a car loan or a mortgage. Now, how much the government pays in interest depends on, well, one, the total national debt and the various borrowed securities interest rates. The higher the interest rate, the higher the government outlays on interest for debt in any government given fiscal year and vice versa. As of August 2023, with higher interest rates and total debt, it costs $808 billion to maintain our debt annually, about 2.9% of GDP. In all of fiscal year 2020, it cost $523 billion, just 2.1% of GDP that year. Now, with the Fed poised to keep interest rates higher for longer, government outlays for interest on the debt will almost certainly surge in the coming years, if not decades. Now, there's also the debt ceiling in the news a lot over the past couple of months. The debt ceiling, or debt limit, as it's sometimes called, is a restriction imposed by Congress on the amount of outstanding national debt that the federal government can have at any given time. The debt ceiling is the amount that the Treasury can borrow to pay the government bills that are due and to pay for future investments based on previously approved congressional appropriations. Once the ceiling is reached, the federal government can't increase the amount of outstanding debt, thus losing its ability to pay bills and fund programs and services. However, the Treasury can use what's known as extraordinary measures authorized by Congress to temporarily suspend certain intergovernmental debt. That allows it to borrow to fund programs or services on a limited basis after it's reached the debt ceiling. Now, even though the U.S. has never technically defaulted on its debt, the repercussions of a default would likely be chaotic at best, if not catastrophic, in financial markets around the world. But we don't know. As a result of its skyrocketing debt, and the dysfunction of politics in Washington and throughout the nation, Fitch Ratings in August lowered the government's credit rating from its coveted AAA to AA+. That followed a similar downgrade by S&P in 2011 following another debt ceiling impasse. And Moody's has threatened to downgrade as well, particularly because of ongoing threats related to the debt ceiling and congressional dysfunction. In June, Congress suspended the debt ceiling of $33.1 trillion until January 2025, after the next presidential election. So, what comes next? Part two of our four-part series will be published in next Monday's American Survival newsletter. So stay tuned. You and your children's pocketbooks are at stake. Hey, that's all the time we have for today's program. I'm off the rest of the week, but we'll be back next Tuesday. Look for our weekly blog on Friday in part two of our four-part series on deficits and debt in next Monday's American Survival newsletter. Butch will join Melody tomorrow, along with Wendy Wilson of Apothecary Herbs. Thanks, as always, to our production engineer extraordinaire, Todd Waite, and to you, our loyal listeners, for tuning into Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. Please be safe out there. Have a good evening. Bye-bye.
And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad. I've got you.